Oh, it's gonna be a shame to say goodbye to this week, huh, everybody? Brett, how was the week for you?
Oh my God, this was such a great week, John.
It was amazing.
I definitely remember everything that happened in an offhand.
In an offhand way.
Are you all right?
I'm glad that you're here.
No, do you want to go back in time to before we started the show so you can get ready for it?
No, I'm okay. No, I'm very much ready. And I'm going to demonstrate that right now. Not only are we going to be starting off with the right-wing effort to smear Ilhan Omar yesterday by deceptively editing and mass pushing out some video of her from last year, which we're going to break down who did it and who refuses to admit what they did the day after they did it. We also have a couple of awesome guests who are going to be joining us. So journalist Garrett Graff is going to be talking about the history of the CBP, some of the sort of baked-in dysfunction there, how sort of messed up it's been since the very beginning and how things have only gotten worse over time. We're also going to be joined by writer for the Daily Beast, Aurora Snow, to talk about an effort to take some of the sexual harassment out of the pornography industry. Along the way, we've got Donald Trump continuing his war against Fox News. We've got some insane racism coming out of students at Ole Miss. And NBC News publicized a new climate change study, and people responded to it on Twitter, and we just have to show you some of what was said, just in case you have any remaining faith in humanity. Mm-hmm. Was that prepared enough for you?
That was amazing, John.
Thank you.
I mean, I wasn't listening to you, but mm-hmm. It sounded like you said a lot of words in a row correctly. Oh my God, good bit.
Yeah.
That's a really
That's
good bit.
What you get for
she
what you did.
John could do bits. He I don't just do did
bits.
A bit.
I don't do bits. I do skits, actually, don't as all the skit. Great the comedians do.
This gets.
Okay, I have no idea how we're going to transition now to talking about an Islamophobic attack against Congresswoman, but we're going to try with this on Ilhan Omar, okay? The war against Ilhan Omar continues, this time with a video of her. This is from last year. She was on Al Jazeera with Mehdi Hassan, and she was talking about terrorism. And there's two videos that are important here. It's the video of what she said, and the video that right-wingers across the country have been exposed to, because what happened was they deceptively edited the video, taking out a chunk from the middle that made clear that she was using a sort of rhetorical flourish, as well as more context afterward. Now, rather than confusing you by showing you the full video and then what the right-wingers were using and spreading on Twitter, Parker Malloy on Twitter, she did a great thing where she put together the full video and then just highlighted the sections that were removed. So we're gonna show you the video now, the first part, and take a look at what was removed.
A lot of conservatives in particular would say that the rise in Islamophobia is a result not of hate, but of fear, a legitimate fear, they say, of quote unquote jihadist terrorism, whether it's Fort Hood or San Bernardino or the recent truck attack in New York. What do you say to them?
I would say our country should be more fearful of white men across our country, because they are actually causing most of the deaths within this country. And so if fear was the driving force of policies to keep America safe, Americans safe inside of this country, we should be profiling, monitoring, and creating policies to fight the radicalization of white men.
Okay, so you saw there the section about if that was the way we were going to run our country was based on these overblown fears, then the first thing I said and the last thing I said would be true. But she's making clear that that's not how she wants our policies to be run. That section being taken out is just about the most dishonest thing you can do. By the way, it's like a 10-second section. So it's not even like you can say, well, the video was too long, I couldn't post the whole thing. You could have left that in, you didn't, and you know why.
Right, well, if they left that in, then they wouldn't have a point.
Yes.
You know, they couldn't do that thing that they do literally all the time, mm-hmm. which is, and Parker Malloy, who posted that, that's where I saw it. She does a good job of outlining essentially the move. Mm-hmm. The conservative move, which is, listen, I'm going to be utterly disingenuous in trying to spread this thing around because I know that this will be easily spread around.
Yeah.
And people will come back right after and disprove pretty much every single aspect of it. But that's not my priority. My priority is getting supporters on the right to have like a very quick thing they can spread and a quick quip they can share mm-hmm. that allows them to write someone off.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened here.
Yeah, and so we're not gonna show you all of the different people that spread the video with the section cut out, but it was all over the place. And Parker did a great job of collecting, just it is just a murderer's row of right-wing pundits and writers and Twitter personalities and Republican politicians who were just so gleeful, like Dave Rubin tweeting like, ooh, let's play that game of is this racist or not? Because he totally watched the full video and did research about it. But Dana Loesch, she covered it on a radio show. Marco Rubio enthusiastically tweeting it out. And then versions of those videos were also played on Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham. Understand, they used all of this after we already knew that the video that was being spread was manipulated. But they just loved it and they had to have it. Quick point, she's not actually saying that by the numbers we should be more afraid of white men. But realistically, we probably should be, because according to the FBI's Ray, head of the FBI, most domestic terrorism arrests this year involve white supremacy. And we know if you go back years and years, that's where the deaths are coming from. Now, she's not making that point, but I'm a white male. I think I have the cover to say, yes, if you're actually going to be based demographically fear of someone, it should probably be the people who are actually committing the terror attacks.
Yeah. This is the classic situation that people on the left have when trying to figure out how to handle people on the right, because she wants to make a complex point. Mm-hmm. She says, if I were to be crazy like you guys, I would say something crazy like, we should be afraid of all white people. They get rid of the if,
yeah.
But she wants to make a moderate, like I wouldn't even say moderately, a kind of sophisticated point. Mm-hmm. But do you avoid making those kinds of sophisticated points because you know you're going to get taken out of context? If you do start to change the way you present your arguments to account for something like that, what we've seen time and time again is they will take literally anything out of context. Yeah. So if you are trying to not even dumb down your argument, but simplify them into quick little bits,
yeah,
it won't necessarily do anything. That's one way to look at it. Yeah. I do think that from time to time, like, probably best to avoid saying things like this. Like I think that it's getting away from like the simplistic messaging aspect of politics mm-hmm. that the right is so very good at. And the reason they're able to be good at it is that they have such an eager base to repeat whatever is said to them.
Yeah. Yeah, I get what you're saying. And there's probably certain things that I would agree. It's not worth it just because of how fake they are. But first of all, it sucks that it's on us. And I question, is there a level of careful we can be that will overpower how disingenuous and nihilistic they are?
So you say careful. And I kind of pose it as this discussion to have, but my actual opinion on it is it's not being careful. Mm-hmm. It's being good at it. It's being mm-hmm. better at it. It's being effective at it. And yes, I think that part of it is the moderates within the so-called moderates within the party being too careful.
Yeah.
And not focusing on being the most straightforward, simplistic, and effective they can be. That's why you get this wishy-washy feeling out of Nancy Pelosi being like, I don't want to do this. It's up to you if you want to do impeachment or not. But I think if it is a simple, straightforward argument like, hey, here is a list of policies that most Americans agree on, and it's pretty obvious why. We're just going to make our platform that. Mm-hmm. It'll be healthcare for everybody, Medicare for all. It'll be eliminating this huge debt that students face, and a list of other things that you can see that Bernie Sanders does a very good job of communicating on his messaging.
Final point. So, you know, the initial video went out, right wingers just jumped in it, could not even spare a minute or two to see if what they were watching was true. I mean, this is to everybody. Now, obviously, Dana Loesch isn't watching. She's not going to learn anything. She's paid very well not to learn anything. But for everyone, if you watch a video and you think, oh my God, that is everything I wanted it to be, and you notice that there's like a cut in the middle, maybe there's a reason that there's a cut in that middle. Not necessarily, videos do have to be edited down. But if it just confirms everything you want to believe is true and it has some cuts, maybe look into it a little bit. Now, it's been revealed, obviously, that the video was deceptively edited. Marco Rubio doubled down. Dana Loesch is flailing like a dozen, 20 tweets about why she's still right. When we know exactly what they did. They saw it, they probably didn't even watch the full deceptively edited video, and they retweeted it with something snarky because they thought it proved their point. because they were so blinded by their hatred and suspicion of people like Ilhan Omar that they couldn't be bothered to do a couple of minutes of research. Okay, we're gonna take a couple of minutes off. We got a great interview coming up. We're gonna talk about the CBP, its history of dysfunction, after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
When these women tell me that they were put into a cell and that their sink was not working, and we tested the sink ourselves and the sink was not working, and they were told to drink out of a toilet bowl, I believe them.
There we have Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talking about her trip down to a facility near the border and the conditions that she saw there. In the full video, portions of which we've talked about previously on the show, she describes a number of different, really just truly incomprehensible ways that we're forcing these people to live, and for some of them, to die. But the problems that we're having right now at these facilities are not necessarily just a problem of now, and there's very good reason to believe that some of the problems in CBP have been brewing for a long time. And joining us now to talk about both the current situation and the historic issues with that organization, journalist Garrett Graff, welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you on. So let's, I guess, start at present. There's this debate over how bad things are. You know, they go down with their delegation and it looks really bad, but then on Fox I hear that they have Xboxes. So what is it actually like there?
Well, I haven't been to the same facility that Representative Ocasio-Cortez attended, but I've been in similar facilities. And, you know, this is detention and migration at an industrial scale. This is not necessarily a new problem. We are about 6 years into this crisis of Northern Triangle migrants fleeing to seek asylum in along this U.S. southern border. That is people from Guatemala, El Salvador, and the other Central American countries fleeing north to the Rio Grande Valley, which is the closest point to the along the U.S.-Mexican border. And they are trying to seek asylum from gang violence and drug violence, and that this is something that we have seen tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands annually for about 6 years. Yes. The major change in the policy that's driving the conditions in the detention facilities now is that the Trump administration is no longer releasing these asylum seekers into the United States with what are called notices to appear for future immigration proceedings. They are keeping them detained until those proceedings can begin.
And so thereby, from the perspective of a few years ago, the numbers are being sort of semi-artificially or at least politically inflated, that the problem is being exacerbated by an unwillingness to continue the previous policy. So I'm curious though, I want to be able to the extent that we can, figure out what of these problems are sort of being caused by the current regime, the current policy, and the current objectives. And what do we know about the history of CBP going back to its creation? Have there been warning signs along the way? Was there reason to be concerned, you know, 3, 10 or more years ago?
Yeah, and this was really the core of my article, is that there is nothing that we are seeing today that has not been long foretold about the fundamental systemic organizational institutional challenges facing the Border Patrol and its parent agency, Customs and Border Protection. And what you are seeing are really a legacy set of problems due to the sort of mismanagement of the Border Patrol and CBP that stretches back more than a decade. CBP founded in 2004 as part of the reorganization that led to the Department of Homeland Security from various legacy components, including the old U.S. Customs Service and the old INS, the old Immigration and Naturalization Service. And that was an agency that has actually really struggled to get good leadership over any part of the three presidencies under which it has existed: George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump. This is an agency that has seen at least 10 different leaders over 16 years of existence at this point. It's on its third leader of the Trump administration. And it actually took 6 years in the Obama administration for Obama to appoint the first Senate-confirmed leader of CBP. So this has been a rudderless agency that during most of that time has been growing rapidly, more than doubled in size during the Bush and Obama years, and now represents both the largest law enforcement agency in the United States, larger than the Coast Guard, which is the smallest branch of our military, and is an agency that does not have a workforce well aligned to what its modern day task is either. This is a long foreseen problem where it has struggled during that rapid period of growth beginning more than a decade ago with an epidemic of crime and corruption, such that for 7 years, from 2005 to 2012, one CBP officer or agent was arrested every single day. And even today, we're seeing numbers, a CBP agent or officer arrested about every 36 hours. I mean, that's a stunning level of misconduct, ranging from domestic violence and assault and battery, all the way up to murder. We saw one Border Patrol agent arrested last fall for being allegedly a serial killer, killing four sex workers in Texas with his CBP-issued firearm. And as shocking and surprising as that should be, he was not even the first Border Patrol agent from his own office arrested for murder last year.
So is the solution, what is the solution, I guess? Is it that they need more people working there? It seems like from what you just communicated to us, it is an inherent corruption within the system. But is it getting rid of it, reorganizing the whole thing once again? Because since this reorg you mentioned, it has never been effective. Or is it just leadership? How do they solve it? And does that come down to more funding? What's your suggestion or recommendation?
Yeah, I think that there are three institutional structural issues that are quite clear that needs to be addressed. One, stable, reform-minded leadership. It's almost impossible to have any sort of institutional reform when you are rotating leadership every 9 to 12 months. Two is it needs to align its workforce with what its actual modern-day tasks are. I mean, part of this issue is that during that rapid hiring growth post 9/11, when you saw the agency more than double in size, it went out and was recruiting for what it was calling a elite counterterrorism force focused on fighting Al-Qaeda, fighting drug cartels. And most of what the Border Patrol is doing on a day-to-day basis right now is effectively serving as a humanitarian relief organization. That's not the work that the Border Patrol agents signed up to do. And it's not work that they are either particularly well equipped to do While at the same time, it is taking them away from the work that actually does need to be done of fighting drug trafficking and human smuggling along the southern border. You know, cartels know that by flooding the border patrol with these asylum-seeking migrants, they are tying up resources that allows the cartels to sneak through drugs and human trafficking elsewhere along the border much more easily. So I think that there's an interesting question of whether the Border Patrol needs a stronger humanitarian relief component to its workforce, potentially even a civilian workforce that works alongside the trained federal law enforcement of the Border Patrol and the Office of Field Operations in CBP. And then I think the third thing is, you know, a legitimate deep policy conversation in the U.S. about what we want to do with illegal and legal migration and immigration. That this is a subject that the Border Patrol in some ways is serving as the central failure point for a country that is deeply unsure of what it actually wants to do about immigration in our society. And that's not the Border Patrol's problem, that we as a country, we as a Congress, we as a people are not sure what the policy is we want to try to enforce. But it does become the Border Patrol's problem to be sort of stuck with this wave of migrants representing a failure of the other agencies of government, like ICE, like the Department of Health and Human Services, who are responsible for refugees and asylum seekers, that ICE and HHS's inability to confront this problem means that the Border Patrol is left with these overcrowded detention facilities like Representative Ocasio-Cortez witnessed.
Exactly. And, you know, I both enjoyed your write-up. There's a lot more historical detail in there available at Political Magazine. And so thank you so much, Garrett, for joining us and breaking down this issue.
My pleasure.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, a lot more to get to. Three students from Ole Miss have been suspended from their fraternity and might face even more consequences after posting an absolutely horrendous photo of them posing in front of a sign memorializing Emmett Till. And we're gonna show you the picture, and we're gonna talk about their particular case. But before we get to that, just in case you don't know about that story and why what you're going to see is so horrendous, we do want to fill you in just a little bit of the details of this incredibly tragic moment in America's past. Back in 1955, 14-year-old Emmett Till left Chicago to spend the summer with relatives near Money, Mississippi. Till went to a country store and encountered a white woman named Carol Bryant, who alleged that Till grabbed her and whistled at her. The woman's husband, Roy Bryant, and his half-brother kidnapped the boy. Till's mutilated body, beaten, shot, and weighed down with a 74-pound cotton gin fan, was found in the Tallahatchie River soon after. Now, that is absolutely horrendous. The fact that those two men who kidnapped and murdered this 14-year-old child got off after virtually no trial and then gleefully admitted that they had done it shortly thereafter is terrible as well. It's just a horrendous moment. Now, the fact that he died in such a horrific way and his mother's choice to display his body in an open casket so that people would be forced to see the reality that is so often hidden and certainly was back in the 1950s helped to spur a movement to stop that sort of thing. But it's horrendous, and you would hope that people will have learned the right lesson coming out of it, but as we're gonna show you, clearly some have not. Before we get to the actual picture, I mean, this is Ole Miss and it's Kappa Alpha members. That puts a certain context on what's gonna happen.
So a lot of people, when they think frats, think just a racist group of white guys hanging out. And KA among fraternities is known as the particularly racist one.
And you are, I was never in a fraternity member, but you were.
I was in a fraternity, some facts about fraternities. I know that Stanford's KA was the first racially integrated KA in the United States. For example, the KA at USC in Southern California is off campus because it's not allowed to be on campus anymore. And they paint a Mason-Dixon line on the front porch, Mason-Dixon line separating the North and South in the Civil War era.
Yeah.
That is it. It is the inspiring, if you click on, if you go to the KA website, it talks about their inspiration and the person on whom the entire fraternity is founded, and it's Robert E. Lee.
Just to give you an idea.
And this takes place at Ole Miss, the Rebels.
Yes. And so, and one more bit of context, just because we were talking about this before the show. If Emmett Till had not been kidnapped and murdered by these white supremacists, he would be 78 years old. And so you hear the story and you think, well, that was a really long time ago. Kind of. If he were alive and he were running for president, he would barely be the oldest, actually. It wasn't that long ago that this happened. It's long enough that you would hope that people, that we would have progressed. But for some people, we haven't. And so now we turn to the picture. Here is the picture that got those three students suspended from their fraternity. Those are three grinning, gleeful college students posing with a variety of different firearms in front of a memorial sign that itself has been shot up. We don't know if they shot it or if they just posed with guns in front of a sign that other racists shot at.
Because this happens all the time.
Yeah, so we're gonna go through the history, actually. We do have that. I just want to say very quickly. So Ben LeClaire, how did we find out about this? Posted the picture on John Lowe's, two of the individuals in the picture, birthday, with the message, quote, "One of Memphis's finest and the worst influence I've ever met." That's half true, I guess, perhaps. But eventually ProPublica and another investigative group were able to get the photo. It was eventually removed after the Mississippi Center for Investigative Reporting and ProPublica began contacting fraternity members and friends. And this is just the cap on the whole thing. It received 274 likes. That they decided, you know what, this sign memorializing one of the darkest individual moments, we're gonna pose in front of it with guns because we think that that's funny. And literally hundreds of people were like, yes, I like this.
This just goes to further distance people mentally from what actually is happening at any given point. Mm-hmm. So they are in a fraternity, they're looking around. He says, this is one of the worst influences I've ever met. It's like, but he's fine with that. He gleefully posts pictures of it. And I know this dynamic. This is the dynamic where people hang out. Mm-hmm. And because no one's really calling out what's actually happening, they get to just happily do it. Mm-hmm. And what we have to do, the onus is on us, essentially, sadly, to call out, this is actually terrible.
Yeah.
This was a 14-year-old kid who was murdered. The people who did it were acquitted and then later got paid $4,000 in an interview back in 1950, whatever, which was a lot of money, to admit it.
To admit it. And then live the rest of their life free of any consequences whatsoever. And so, the whole thing is just terrible. I mean, those three individuals being so confident that, like, yeah, everybody I know likes this sort of thing. It's not gonna be a big deal or whatever. Hypothetically, there is a fourth person because, of course, unless they set up a tripod, somebody was holding that camera. We don't know who that person was. They had the good sense to not be in the picture at the very least. That's about as far as their sense goes. There's one more little detail that we alluded to, and that's the history of this particular sign, let alone all the other horrible details, and we could talk for a long time about it. I just want you to bear in mind, when you hear Republican pundits and Republican politicians say that America is not a racist society, it never was, but it certainly isn't now because we elected a black president. I mean, just this one sign's experience, bear this in mind. So vandals threw the first sign in the river. They tore it down, they threw it in the river. The second sign was blasted with over 300 bullets or shotgun pellets before the Emmett Till Memorial Commission officials removed it. A third sign, that's the one featured in the Instagram photo, already had 10 bullet holes in it before it was taken down last week. A fourth sign is being designed to better withstand the attacks that we all know will come. We now need bulletproof memorials in America because we know what's coming. So just remember that when you hear people saying that, come on, we elected Barack Obama, we're good.
Make it bigger and bigger and bigger every time, and stronger and stronger and stronger every time.
I agree.
They were suspended from KA, not from, I mean, from yes. The reports. They were suspended by their fraternity but not by Ole Miss. Mm-hmm. Ole Miss says this is kind of outside, wasn't on campus, what can we do? But what do we expect from a university that continues to go by the mascot, the Rebels? And it looks like it is a Confederate soldier is their mascot. Mm-hmm. So what are you gonna expect?
Exactly. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to. There are a number of stigmatized industries in the United States. Few, though, have the level of stigma as the adult film industry. And certainly none have, at the same time, the amount of stigma and the sheer consumption of their product on a daily basis. And so, considering how popular the industry is, reforms to protect the people who actually participate in the industry have been very slow in coming. But here in California, there is one bill. It's the Talent Protections Act. Designed to minimize some of the pervasive sexual harassment against people working in the adult film industry. Joining us now to talk about the history in the industry and this bill, which might reform it, is journalist writing for the Daily Beast, Aurora Snow. Aurora, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. I very much enjoyed your write-up about this. And you talked about your own personal history of experience at the hands of this sort of pervasive sexual harassment. This bill, based on what you've experienced, do you think that it would do much to protect women working now from that sort of abuse?
Well, I think it's not just about the bill so much that now there's going to be an awareness directly from talent agents. Back when that happened to me, you know, technically I have a long list of things that count as sexual harassment. But when those things happened to me, I didn't think of it in those terms. And I feel like this generation of performers coming in will start thinking about it in those terms and handling it differently because of this bill.
And in your write-up, you talked not only about the experience of being harassed, but one of the things that was most striking was when you reached out to other people in the industry, your makeup artists, your co-stars, how normalized it actually was. Can you talk about that?
It was incredibly normalized to have a director call me over and have me sit on his lap and grope me and, you know, essentially try to have sex before the scene was something that I was supposed to be flattered about. To have male talent maybe come up to you, lift up your shirt, check you out, slap you on the ass before you're seen. Those types of things are sexual harassment, but it was the norm. And in many cases still is. And so talking about it in context of, hey, I feel like this was misconduct to other talent and the makeup artist on set, nobody looks at it that way. And then suddenly you become the complainer or the person who doesn't quite fit in to the culture.
And so that really like completes the circle of the sexual harassment, hostile work environment, where you, even at a young age, you had a sense that your career could be at risk if you were, like you did raise it as an issue, and unfortunately people didn't have your back. But if you had made a bigger deal out of it, that hypothetically your career could have been severely harmed or perhaps eliminated, correct?
Oh, absolutely. If I had made a big deal out of that, I would have been booked less. I would have been considered difficult to work with. And those aren't the kind of reputations that you want to have a successful career.
And so you talked about how it's not just legislation like the Talent Protections Act, but a change in culture and awareness of what's going on. Over the past few years, we've had simultaneously the Me Too movement. We've also had incredibly powerful people successfully rebuff accusations of sexual harassment and assault, even by dozens of people. To the extent that you know, currently, through the course of the years of the Me Too movement, have we seen an evolution inside of the adult film industry in terms of how these actresses are treated and perceived?
We've definitely seen an evolution brought on by the awareness. Now we're having conversations where directors and colleagues, fellow performers are sitting down and having conversations before the scene, and they're talking about things like consent, what's going to happen, what's acceptable. Those conversations weren't happening before. But now we also have this awareness in terms of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. However, there is still an issue with women speaking up on set because they are still dealing with labels like difficult or, hey, she's, you know, you don't want to work with this person because she's going to create problems. When in fact, it's not a problem. It should be okay to address harassment in the workplace.
And there's been a couple, especially in California, because a large portion of the industry is situated here. There have been, over the past few years, a few different sorts of bills, attempts at reform in the industry. And it feels like, you know, I obviously have not worked in the industry. It feels like the people starting these reforms, launching these bills, also have not had any direct, past in the industry. As someone who does know what it's actually like, to what extent, if you could craft a bill, what do you think could be done that would actually be beneficial and help to protect these performers?
In terms of crafting a bill, I think the best thing to do wouldn't be to just speak to one performer. It would be to speak to a group of performers that span generations. You know, somebody who was in it 10 years ago, somebody who's just entering it now, to get those different perspectives of what's going on in the workplace and what needs to be addressed.
Well, Aurora Snow, your work can be found at The Daily Beast. We appreciate you joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, new scientific evidence once again even more strongly confirming human-caused climate change and how the internet reacts after this. The last 2 weeks have been tumultuous for Donald Trump. Last week, he went on an extended racist rampage against members of the squad and only stopped that temporarily, he'll get back to it, to spend this week, to hear him tell it, exulting in how great the Mueller testimony has been for him. An account of his emotional reaction to that that's been somewhat undercut by sources inside of his administration. So I'm always concerned with how exactly he's approaching politics, what's on his mind. My defense mechanism is to sort of joke about his state of mind, but there are people who take it very seriously, and we're joined now by one of them, forensic psychiatrist, currently working on the faculty of Yale School of Medicine's Law and Psychiatry Division, Dr. Bandy Lee. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Thank you for having me.
Always glad to have you on. This is an important time for you and your work to get people to take seriously Donald Trump's mental state. Why is it such an important time?
I think we have been seeing a lot of signs of deterioration. As you've noticed, the back and forth about race and essentially expression of his racist bias, but also he's using racism to funnel his attacks, and the increase of attacks and agitation, if you will, is kind of a reflection of his state of mind.
And so do you believe that his state of mind, you're saying there that it's reacting to something, is that grounded in concerns over this week's political developments, or do you think that it might be part of a sort of ongoing process that's been developing?
Well, that's right. The Mueller Robert Mueller's report and his testimony have been a large part of this. We can know from the president's own statements about them, but also the timing of it. No matter how much he says, they do not matter that much to him. We discover that he's been tweeting more as the testimony is moving forward, and he pretty much lays bare his state of mind kind of has the viewer or the recipient of his attacks, if you will, have a small dose of what he's feeling inside.
So there are a few things that have been happening over the past 2 weeks that I just want to see if you think that my read might be a little bit accurate, that if he is under stress, if he is feeling anxious about what's developing, the fact that we had the send them back chant and the doubling down and the conversation around that, you had the accusations of treason against the people who'd investigated him this week, and a seemingly unrelated bit of news, which was the restarting of the federal death penalty. All of this might be unconnected, but it feels to me like, I don't know, like lashing out to some extent. Does that make any sense?
It makes total sense. I think it's important to look at the patterns and look at the results rather than looking at things piecemeal. In fact, we understand a lot more if we look at the overall picture and look at the means by which he copes with stress and difficulty. He tends to attack. He becomes cruel. He incites violence. And this is exactly why we have been calling him a dangerous president. That Mr. Trump in the office of the presidency is a very dangerous situation, and it will only escalate.
And I should mention that you're the author of The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. You recently, I believe like 3 days ago, you presented a mental health analysis of the Mueller report with recommendations. I know we can't cover everything, but what are some of the recommendations that you made?
So actually, when the redacted Mueller report came out, we did a mental health analysis. In other words, an evaluation of the president's mental capacity. We were able to do that because of the wealth and quality of the information, the relevance of the information that was in the Mueller report. It's exactly the kind of thing we would look for. The reports of close associates of the president who have worked with him, both allies and opponents, have given direct reports of how he has been functioning at his work, under sworn testimony. So it was the best kind of information we could have for a functional exam, which does not necessarily require a personal examination, but it examines mental capacity, which is the basic mental ability to make sound, rational, reality-based decisions. And we were quite alarmed by the fact that he failed every criteria. These are standardized exams that we do all the time. We didn't alter the procedure for the president. And in fact, the results were so much worse than we expected that we recommended immediate removal of access to nuclear weapons and war-making powers. These were just the two most important recommendations. We have many more.
And so I certainly advise our viewers to go look at the rest of those recommendations. That was a horrifying note to end the interview on, the access to nuclear weapons. But as always, Dr. Bandy Lee, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, the report is on dangerouscase.org, and it also includes some questions that we had for Mr. Mueller for his testimony.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, why don't we turn to one more topic while we've got you here. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the recent polling. Not necessarily the polling so much, but the conversation around it. Donald Trump is a guy who is very interested in how things are measuring in terms of ratings, and certainly when it comes to elections in terms of polling. And so recently, when Fox News was talking about some general election polling, he was not a big fan of it. Here is what was said on Fox and Friends.
Head to head with the president, he beats President Trump by 10 points. Sanders beats him by 6. Warren and Harris, basically flat-footed tie.
Early, barely by it, doesn't matter.
And by the way, while he is a fool, Pete Hegseth is not necessarily wrong. He's not necessarily wrong, but you saw there, Fox and Friends is willing to at least admit that the general election polling for Donald Trump is not going so well. And it's on Fox and Friends, so Donald Trump was watching, and they knew that. So he tweeted almost instantly, Fox News is at it again. So different from what they used to be during the 2016 primaries and before. Proud warriors, now new, like the Klingons, now new Fox polls, which have always been terrible to me. They had me losing big to Crooked Hillary, had me down to Sleepy Joe. I hate even saying that. I shouldn't say it in the future. Even considering the fact that I have gone through a 3-year vicious witch hunt perpetrated by the lamestream media in collusion with Crooked and the Democrat Party. If you just woke someone up from hypersleep and read them that paragraph, it would not mean anything. But that's the weird world we're living in.
So you have Klingon reference and hypersleep in the same span?
I've been reading a lot of sci-fi recently. Something Skeksis. Anyway, so he says there can be no way that he's losing to the sleepy one, which sort of adds a little bit of, I don't know, it's sort of glorifying the Joe Biden thing.
So here's the thing. Donald, this is lame, how you are losing to a sleepy man. You Cranky Boy are losing to Sleepy Man. Mm-hmm. You should be sad. You should be distraught. They didn't make up those polls. You are losing. That is bad for you. So if anyone's lame, it's the guy who's losing to the person that you're labeling as comatose.
Yeah, and I will say, as we always say, this poll, as the wise man Pete Hegseth once said, it's really early, doesn't mean anything. That's true. Don't get complacent off of polls right now when it's still like 6 months to the first primary vote. Don't get complacent on polls the day of the election. Don't get complacent, by the way, on the results of the election, because they're likely to be contested one way or another. So I'm not really concerned about what the polls say. It's got, you know, it's got Biden up, it's got Bernie up, it's got a bunch of people up against him. What I'm interested in is all it takes is Fox briefly acknowledging reality. And Donald Trump is very publicly attacking them. And we know that where Donald goes, his base goes. And so I think that this is not only putting pressure on Fox, which is as deferential as any media outlet, I would say, outside of maybe OAN, is to any president. But it's probably going to be effective pressure. Fox and Friends doesn't want to get, you know, bombarded with tweets from Trump fans that suddenly hate them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the strategy. Mm-hmm. The strategy is to Trump to be Cesar Millan, the dog whisperer, is that what he is?
Yeah.
And then to have the Fox News be their little canine pet. Mm-hmm. And for every time they step even remotely or perceptibly or imperceptibly out of line, him to go, and this is him going,
yeah.
And that's it, and it'll work. And it continues to work. The only time it doesn't work is occasionally with Chris Wallace, who within 24 hours will go back the other way.
Which he did this week.
Also,
Shep Smith, I would say he's even more consistently.
But where's he been?
I don't know.
I don't hear it, and I don't see it, which is possible that Donald doesn't watch Shep.
That's true.
And that could perfectly explain it.
Yeah, the only thing sort of complicating your Cesar Millan analogy is that in this case, if the dog barks, very likely he will also bark, because we know he will live tweet what they say.
Yeah.
But in any event, I would love to not have this sort of weird incestuous relationship between a major media outlet and a presidency. I don't think that we've seen anything like this in recent years, and I would love to go back to a time when we don't necessarily have that.
Trump loses it when Fox News admits reality. That is the message.
That might be the title.
But yeah, that's it. I mean, Trump loses it every time Fox slips and admits what's happening in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's something, that's the message.
That probably is the lesson. Okay, so we're gonna take a break. See you on the other side. A new study published in the journal Nature shows that the sort of heating that we're seeing across the globe is like nothing we've seen in literally thousands of years of human history. And yet that study, some of the news articles about it, I think have too high of an opinion of how that sort of information will be received. Take a look at this headline. It says, climate scientists drive stake through the heart of skeptics' argument. Which I would say objectively in terms of the information, they did do that. But as you're going to see, it did not convince some of the skeptics. Before we get to those skeptics, really fast, here's some interesting information that you should probably know as a person who lives on Earth. Since the beginning of the 20th century, the global average temperature on Earth has risen by about 2 degrees Fahrenheit. In the absence of concerted efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, the UN says the global average temperature could rise an additional 5.4 to 9 degrees Fahrenheit by 2100. Either of those would be absolutely devastating. And so thankfully there are people who are working to make sure that that doesn't happen. But do you want to see some skeptics?
I am skeptical myself. So if I wanted that, John, I'd look in the mirror.
Do you feel that there is a stake that's been driven through your heart by this new data?
Poppycosh.
Okay, so let's see. So NBC News, they tweeted out. Let's take a look at this tweet. Just describing the findings of the study, new research shows that the recent rise, blah, 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 basically what I said in the beginning. And the response from people who I have to assume are also climate scientists comes in a couple different forms. Some people not too worried. Paul Chapman said, not to worry, God is in control. That's good, that's one less thing to worry about.
Oh my gosh.
Now, I'm not trying to mock people's faith, but this person is using that faith to say we should not do anything about this.
I just want to say that most of the Bible is about here's how not to do bad and make God angry. Mm-hmm. I think that if you ruin God's creation by your own acts, that is sin. Mm-hmm. So I would rather reframe this as us ruining things for God. The first part of the Bible is God gave you a paradise and you ruined it. Yeah. Granted, he blamed it on ladies and snakes, but we ruined it.
Yeah.
And that is the foundation for the whole God stuff. Mm-hmm. Why don't we not ruin this paradise, please?
Yeah, and there are mistakes that you can make where you don't necessarily get the warning. Like, you're not immediately told that what you're doing is wrong. You're moving in the wrong direction. But what we're doing is literally making the world more like hell. That's a warning sign. Sort of similar. This is sort of just an ignorance thing. Matt tweeted, but it's done it before.
Matt.
I don't know exactly what that's a reference to, but that's a little bit casual of a response to refute what the work of hundreds of scientists have done.
But that's the smoking gun, right? That is the, I only read the headline of this, and that's enough for me to respond, even though the body of the article disproves his it's done it before argument, which is Trump's half-witted attempt to say climate's change. They go up, they go down, it's good, it's bad. But the article itself says it has never, the entire planet has never done this as far back as 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So when we say, what is precisely what they're referencing, when they try to say it's done it before, this disproves.
Yeah.
What they're referring to only happened in like half the world or a quarter of the world.
Yeah.
This, as we've proven now, is all over.
Yeah. There's the next strategy is a bit of odd fatalism and kind of a threat on the edges. The world ends when it ends, Tangier says. If all the doom and gloom crowd really cared, they would make the ultimate sacrifice to save the earth. But the thing is,
what does that mean?
I'm not sure. It sounds like he's saying kill yourself.
The ultimate sacrifice is giving up your spot in line at like Disneyland.
Exactly. So the thing is, I'm not going to commit suicide. And I don't want anyone to die. That's sort of my goal. The sacrifice we want people to make is like driving an electric car, which has a lot of benefits, not polluting as much, not flying as much. There's a lot of things like that. I don't think anyone should have to commit suicide, honestly. But there was, it's not enough to say the Bible says that this isn't true, or I don't just believe it. A lot of people want to be deniers, but they want to have their denier cake and eat it too. They want to attack this supposedly from a position of science. Or caring about facts. And so some people said things like this. Belinda says, did you check years previous to that? How did you get your figures for before record keeping?
All that's in the article. All of it.
Wait, so you're saying that these people should have read the write-up? By the way, we're not saying they should have read the raw study. They should have read the one-page article on NBC about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would have been nice.
The one-page article on NBC essentially just goes like, well, you can check coral.
Mm-hmm.
You know, depending on how hot it is.
So really fast, because not everybody knows how this is done. There's books about it, but really fast. There are a few ways, before thermometers. Data on old trees' growth rings, layers of glacial ice, and the remnants of corals whose layers have different chemical compositions depending on the temperature of seawater. They go into detail about how exactly before thermometers you're able to tell. But the people who responded, they're willing to say, let's not do anything, but they don't care enough to read an article.
Yeah.
That is absurd.
It makes sense. They definitely want to get it out there. They want to be part of the conversation. They just don't want to listen.
Exactly. So briefly, some other subgroups you might be familiar with weighed in. So I saw this from Matt Fonseca, who said 11,000 to 5,000 years ago, the Sahara was green. 2,000 years is a sliver of time. I need more. Which on its face kind of seems reasonable. Like, I just want more data. This is a person who demands more evidence. And as a person who cares about evidence, I respect that. I respect it up until the time I click on his account and I see hashtag MAGA, hashtag QAnon, hashtag WWG1WGA.
What is that?
That's when we go one, we go all, which is the battle cry of the QAnon person who believes that Donald Trump is working with Robert Mueller to get out an infestation that's lasted for hundreds of years of Democratic pedophiles who've controlled everything in the country. This person just wants more evidence for the things he believes.
This is my favorite John, though.
Okay, hold on.
My favorite John is the like, I told you all the facts and you're still not with me. I told you every reason
to be with me. This is beyond that. This is you saying, I just want more facts. Pizzagate, I believe that it's a true thing. Q baby, go. They believe a Q on a baby before they believe thousands of years of scientific analysis. Abraham Woodhull chimes in, the thermometer was invented just over 300 years ago, which is a fact, sort of.
Yes, exactly.
Not a relevant one.
Chewbacca's a Wookiee.
That's true.
That's it. Chewbacca's a Wookiee.
If Chewbacca's a Wookiee, you must acquit.
Yeah.
Is that a reference?
That is a South Park reference, John. Yes. It just goes to the larger conversation of, well, not even that. Just the observation that people want to comment on stories on the internet. They don't necessarily want to take part in a sophisticated, in a honest conversation about what's actually happening.
Yeah.
They want, everyone is standing in a circle and they want to say like, no, you're stupid, and have a bunch of people go, yeah, he said they're stupid. Yeah. And that's it. Even though the person they're calling stupid is not stupid.
Yeah. And it would be a little bit easier for me to accept that if they didn't also, all of them, every one of them, is so sure that they're critical thinkers and what they care about is logic and evidence and argumentation. All of them are so self-assured in their overwhelming ignorance. And that's frustrating.
Speaking of overwhelming ignorance, watch The Happy Half Hour, 7 p.m. tonight on all the things at the bottom of the screen.
Yeah, there you go. It's going to be great. Thank you, as always, Brett. Great to have you here.
One
next week, I'm out. I'm at the debates in Detroit, and then I'm at Gen Con. Come play a game with me. Lots of great hosts filling in throughout the week. It's going to be awesome. And so we'll see you Monday morning.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.